Hi, and welcome to What's Next in Corporate Real Estate. My name is Michael Kramer, and it's my pleasure to have an old friend in the studio today, Mary Louise Gray. Mary Louise, nice to see you here. How's your day going?
My day's going fine. So like every day, it's unique, and I wake up and I know that this is the list of the things that I'm going to do. And then in the space of probably half an hour, it's all gone out the window and I'm doing something completely different. Hence why I love the role that I do, because every day is different. But it does have its challenges when you do, as we were discussing a little bit earlier, sometimes you've got, you know, a list of things that you absolutely have to do, and trying to fit those in with all the sort of the surprises that turn up every day is always a bit of a challenge.
And maybe we'll come back to that and talk a little bit about how you deal with those challenges and the use of your phone that you were also talking about. But before we do, maybe we could start, go back a couple of years and talk a little bit about how you kind of got into real estate. So background, schooling, university, what made you come up with this grand plan that you've been living?
For a few years. You're so polite. So at school, I did languages. So my A-levels were very much based around arts and languages, and that was really my passion. And so for university, the natural choice was to go off and do languages, but I did team it up with business studies. So I did 2 years at Leeds and absolutely loved it. And then the final year, you could do either in the middle or at the end, which was quite unique for that particular course. You could either go to university in one of the European countries, depending on what language you did, or because Italy, the standard wasn't good enough at that time. This was quite a few years ago. We were sent to Olivetti in Ivrea, just outside of Turin, to actually work. So that was a unique experience. And I did that for a year. And absolutely loved it. And so what that entailed was actually working in the documentation department of Olivetti, actually helping the people who were doing the translations to actually live and have a normal life if they had problems, because none of them spoke Italian. So I was the conduit between, you know, sort of either, you know, the English, the French or the Spanish people who couldn't speak Italian, and I would go and interpret for them or help them to do sort of daily chores, like go to the dentist, do shopping, get accommodation, etc. So it was a fascinating role. And it was there for a year. And once I'd finished that, my boss's secretary had a connection with the lady in HR in London. And so she rang her up, as you did in those days, and she said, I've got this amazing lady. Can you give her a job? And so she said, yep, send her over. So that's exactly what I did. And I walked in and they said, we'd like you to go and do marketing communications. So that was my absolute dream job. It was just brilliant. I was just talking to somebody last week around the role, where it was all about organizing Wimbledon, Grand Prix. In those days, it was at Brands Hatch and not at Silverstone. I was also involved in the Italian World Cup in 1990. So we took a whole heap of sort of serious CEOs from building societies and banks, which Olivetti were, they were their sort of stable customers. And we had the most amazing adventure for a week, where we took, you know, 60, 70 sort of CEOs to Italy for a week. And that was the first time that the three tenors had actually sung. And so I was part of that, and it was just an amazing experience. But unfortunately, like all good things like that, unfortunately came to an end.
I was going to say, how do you go from that to real estate? Oh, dear.
Well, he retired. And so it was very unfortunate that he retired. And sort of the connections, and also by that stage in life, it really wasn't sort of the right thing to sort of take people away for a week. Things started to change in the industry. So it was unfortunately with his retirement, and then sort of changes in sort of industry sort of ethics, the role disappeared. So they asked me to create a centralized purchasing department. And as you can imagine, I'd gone from doing sort of some amazing things. We had, you know, tea with the Queen and things like that, down to creating a centralized purchasing department. So I wasn't massively keen, but I said I'd do it. And then I'd go and find another job. So anyway, that job role actually reported into the head of real estate. So nice little segue in here. And when he left, they said, we'd like you also to take on the real estate. So that's how I got into real estate. I had no intention, no ambition, no interest whatsoever in going into real estate. Why not? I'll do it. I'll give it a go. And if I don't like it, I'll leave. And then sort of 25 years on, I'm still here.
So it can't be all bad. But you did go back to university and do a master's in real estate, or was that night school day release?
No, I did. And this is whilst I was at Unisys. So I did a stint going to Bangalore. We built a 10-story building by hand, literally, in Bangalore. And in my trips to Bangalore and back, which was every 2 to 3 weeks, I'd be on a plane for 10 hours and I did all of my studying and everything on the plane. And over a period of time, it took me 10 years. It's really embarrassing, but it took me 10 years. I managed to do, actually it was a bit less than that, about 9, but it took me a long time and I just did it whenever I could and did all the modules, but I loved it. And the reason why I did it was because I felt that everybody around me had a qualification in real estate of some description and I didn't. And I really felt that in order to have credibility, I really needed that on my CV.
So while everyone else was drinking, eating, watching films or sleeping so they could work the next day, you were studying.
I was.
That's pretty impressive.
But I met some really cool people and I loved it. I really did. You know, sort of I really looked forward to the weekly sort of modules that we had wherein everybody got together. And I think, you know, that's one of the things why I'm here, because, you know, a lot of people gave up their time to come to the university and talk about their experiences, etc. And so for me, I'd like to give back what they gave to me. And I felt it was a really, really nice, it was a really good thing to do, is to give back to young people. I wasn't very young, but the rest of the people in the room were. But, you know, to really help and to try and encourage people to come into the industry, because I truly believe this is a fascinating industry and an industry that is growing and evolving over a period of time.
Wow, that's quite a story, which I didn't know. So that's always good to do these things and you find out more about people you thought you knew. So talk to me, let's talk a little bit about career choices and moving from one company to another. So, because we kind of hopped around there, but so you're sure. Olivetti, you then started reporting into the head of real estate. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you decided to move on, or that came to a natural end? Or
no, it didn't come to a natural end. I was headhunted to do a European role. So it was my first gig at a European. Mm. So the Olivetti role was a UK role. Okay. And I felt that I'd now really wanted to sort of start to sort of progress and also to use my languages. So clearly from an Olivetti perspective, I used my Italian every day, but my other languages were getting very rusty. And I felt that it would be a really good thing to actually use those languages. And so I was headhunted for a role at Informix, which actually was corporate real estate and procurement. So it was heading up procurement. So this was almost my start of my corporate services. This was my first real entry into corporate services in a broader sense. So I did that for 2 years, but unfortunately there were some there's some irregularities from a financial perspective. And so I'd spent 18 months opening 18 offices around Europe, and they were beautiful offices. And unfortunately, because of the financial irregularities, they decided that we then needed to go out and start to close some of them out because they just couldn't afford them. And I just felt that, you know, really, you know, I'd really sort of worked. It was interesting. Sort of my week was, I got on a plane on a Monday. I did 3 countries a week. I came home on a Friday, on a Thursday night. And on a Friday, I did my expenses and
my paperwork. Yep.
And that was my life for 18 months. It literally three countries every week, just sort of creating these real estate opportunities right across Europe from Russia to Spain, everywhere. It was a fascinating role. And I just didn't want to close something that just about killed me over the last 18 months to open.
And as you say that, it makes me think of something, because I don't know which year were you doing, what year was the 18 months?
And 1997.
So a lot of those markets that you were dealing in were not like they are today.
No.
In other words, they're very immature. I mean, I can remember going into Russia and Eastern Europe when I started, and you really had to kind of make it up as you went along. Yeah. So maybe it's be fun to talk a little bit about how you, because opening an office sounds relatively easy, which it can be. But in those days, it had a whole bunch of extra complications, let's say, around countries. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what you actually had to do other than the real estate, or as well as the real estate, to make it happen. How does the business work? You don't just turn up in a country and say, oh, I want that one.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. But before that, I'll tell you a little a funny story about my Warsaw experience. So it's the first time I'd ever been to Warsaw, and it was my Helium Baker. So you'll smile.
Another company that doesn't exist, like Informix.
Yeah. So my Helium Baker, he probably does still exist today. He met me at the airport. He took one look at me and he went, "This is not going to work." So it was absolutely freezing. I had totally the wrong clothes. So just to sort of show how naive I was in those days, you got no boots, you had these stupid shoes on, you got no gloves, and Warsaw is absolutely freezing. So immediately he took off his coat, his hat, talk about partnership, and he dressed me in all of his clothes and he got me some boots and said, "Right, we're now going to go and have a look at what property looks like in Warsaw," which was rickety. In those days, everything was done in Deutschmarks.
That's right,
as well.
It was, yeah.
So, you know, these buildings, I mean, today when I go to Warsaw, the world is so different. I mean, it's just glitzy and shiny and sparkly. In those days, the buildings that we went round, you know, sort of the health and safety, the way that they were constructing buildings, he said, you know, that's why he said, he took one look at my shoes and he went, "This is not going to work."
Yeah.
So that sort of shows in context, you know, how things have really, really changed. And it was very, very basic. Mm. And everything was incredibly basic in those days. It was just a case of common sense and trying to sort of make the best decisions that you possibly can and trying to future-proof it. But in those days, also, people didn't talk about exit management and, you know, all the strategies around that as well. So that's changed quite a lot since then, too.
Yeah, well, it's grown. I guess in those days, it was the beginning of the corporate service.
Correct.
Solutions, outsourcing, whatever word we want to use for what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't really exist as an industry.
Not at all.
So we were all making it up as we went along and doing the right thing. And and the financial part of it from corporates was just find me an office, how much does it cost? Whereas now, as you say, this, you've got to think about all sorts of different things.
I think another story to sort of bring it to life was when I did the Bangalore gig. And the foundations of the 10-story building are dug out by women. So the men supervise and the women actually do the digging out. And how they do it is with a big bowl. You know how we've seen people do rice sort of cultivation? So that type of bowl. And they literally scoop it out of the ground by hand. And we were behind schedule. And so I sort of said, "We can't do this. You know, we've got to bring in machinery. We are so behind schedule. And, you know, I've got people screaming from the US, we've got to get moving on this one." They said, "Mary Louise, no, you don't understand the culture. Those people will starve. If you bring in machineries, those people will starve. You cannot do that." And trying to sort of convey that to my lords and masters in the US was quite tricky. It was definitely a challenge. But again, you know, when we do these roles and we talk about the complexities of the role and the cultural you need to really understand the decisions that sometimes are made by people who don't quite understand the ramifications of some of those decisions.
Yeah, and I think actually you touch on another really interesting point in our world, which is not about real estate, but about doing business, is one, who's the client? It's an American corporate, and that comes with a whole set of assumptions.
It does.
And then you're doing business in a different country, and in India is much more developed now than it was. You know, you probably
Correct.
Think it's a bit like some of the African countries today, but a lot of them are much more sophisticated. But there's always a translation needed between what's going on the ground and what is culturally, as you say, culturally the way you do things, or from a business
Absolutely.
Point of view, the way you do things, how you conduct yourself in meetings.
Mm.
I mean, I lived in Hong Kong pre the handover and was going up to China before it is what it is today, and with an interpreter and being told how to behave in meetings, which when you think you know what you're doing is always a strange conversation to be have, but there's a way of doing it. If you want to get, and at the end of the day, you need to get what you need to for your company.
Indeed.
And that still exists today. I mean, if we fast forward today, do you think that's as, it's not whether it's as prevalent, but is it still as important to understand cultural significance, cultural differences, both with who you work for, but also the country in which you're doing that business?
Most definitely. I think there's a better understanding as well. I do think people understand the cultural differences and have more empathy than certainly when I did my Bangalore stint. So that's definitely improved. But I think we still need to remind ourselves constantly And one of the things that I do love about Microsoft is, although we have, you know, huge guidelines, you know, it does say it has to be in sympathy, and it has to, you have to take those cultural nuances into your design when you deliver projects. So that's really refreshing in terms of seeing, you know, some big corporate American guidelines actually, you know, sort of at least acknowledge that, you know, there is some need to modify the designs.
Yeah, and we've kind of fast-forwarded there to today because you work at Microsoft, but I think that's also an interesting area, because what I've noticed in the last few years is we went through a period in the 2000s of globalizing, and what you described is very apt, meaning everyone said we want to do it our way and one way, mm-hmm. and everything's got to be the same. So sort of the McDonald'sization, yes. of real estate, whereas more recently we've seen the shift back to, okay, what's appropriate locally, mm-hmm. and let's be culturally sensitive, because that has a business benefit. I mean, and it's not all about the numbers, but I think most large corporates have realized that different parts of the world work in different ways, and different people Definitely. Want to work in different ways, and what you do in an emerging economy can be different to an established one. So you're saying that in the Microsoft world, that's very much taken into account?
Absolutely.
And how did you do that? Is that down to the individual doing the jobs, or is it, you talked a little bit just then about this, mm-hmm. they lay down some guidelines, or?
Yep, so we have guidelines like most corporations do these days. So, you know, this is the look and feel that we're trying to achieve. You know, this is the sort of the acoustic levels and, you know, the partitions, all of that type of requirements are set out in a book, so that it gives the architect an idea of the standards and specifications that we look for when we do fit outs. So that's the guiding principle, as we call right. it. But then you then start to put your nuances. So for example, in Thames Valley Park, where we're doing a very large fit out within our buildings, is we're taking, because we are very near the river. So we're looking at themes of the river. We're looking at themes in the park that we actually currently are in. So it's taking some of those ideas and actually building it into our designs. And the architect is the lead in terms of looking at that. Plus, we also have obviously people who help. So I have a lady who helps me to ensure that the architect is interpreting the guidelines correctly.
Wow. Okay. And we're bouncing all over the place, which is great. I love that. But that made me think of something else. So you're refurbishing your existing buildings.
We are.
So what?
It's constant.
It's constant. So what are some of the kind of the latest thinking or ideas in terms of the fit out that you're trying to incorporate that are different and moving Microsoft on and relate to its workplace? And I guess what I'm thinking, I mean, you've got a huge amount as a business. The technology you have is driving how we all work, obviously. How do you incorporate that part of the business into the real estate? And is there stuff that you're allowed to talk about that might be interesting?
We're doing some really super cool things with technology. One of the reasons why, when I was approached about the Microsoft role, why did I want to do it? Of course I would. It's super clever in terms of some of the things that we're doing. So, you know, just sort of talking about technologies you walk in. So, you know, hopefully all the swiping in will disappear yeah. as we start to look at that. So some of the things, and we're looking to deliver that in our Singapore office in September.
Using facial recognition.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So looking at all of that. So some of those things, we're also looking at the ways that we intelligently manage buildings as well from an FM perspective. So it has all sorts of different aspects in terms of how we're trying to put technology into our buildings to make them faster, cheaper, and obviously, you know, better customer experience for people as well.
So the technology that Microsoft has, you're using a lot of your own technology to drive, presumably, or try and measure, look at, think about productivity?
Yes. Correct.
So some of it's around the FM, as you said, so getting people into the building earlier. But can you talk about some of the things that that Microsoft has that it's using?
So we're looking at apps. So at the moment, we've got a series of different apps. And one of the things that we're working on is to have one app that, you know, everything that we use internally, we will look to sell. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we actually create them ourselves. We also partner with third parties as well. So Microsoft partners very heavily with lots of different people. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be done by Microsoft, but obviously it's on our cloud technology. So some of it is hosted, by Microsoft. Some of it's created by Microsoft. So there's a combination of different things. So the app brings together all of these services. It's something that we're working on at the moment. And we have a large team in Redmond that is actually focused on technology and how we partner with a business from a real estate and technology perspective. So again, sort of when you look at Microsoft as a corporation, you've got what I call run the business type, which is the role that I'm in. So I run Europe. And then you've got a COE that sort of looks at, you know, the centers of excellence and the technology piece. And then you've got a shared services center I'm just creating the vernacular that most people would understand. Right. That creates all the standard templates, all the standard ways that we do business. And so we draw from these different tenants dependent on what we're doing in terms of a project.
And I don't know if this is true, but sounds that this partnering I'm fascinating by, because I would tend to think of Microsoft as a business that creates software and then sells it that we all run on our computers. And what you're talking about, which I think there's a huge parallel in most businesses, they're now partnering with third parties who in part use the cloud, so use your services, but are going into areas that you wouldn't normally associate Microsoft with, such as real estate.
Sure.
So is that a conscious business decision?
It is.
And that presumably it's not just in real estate, could be across any lines of business, mm-hmm. where they're trying to see how they can help their customers more and what is it their customers
Absolutely.
Want. Yeah, because I've seen some of the presentations that Microsoft have done at Cornet and other things about using sensors, measuring
yes.
where people are in buildings, temperature, you know, noise, all those other things. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool that you're able to partner internally almost to help your own real estate.
Absolutely.
And by doing that, help your customers.
We have another tool that's really useful, particularly in strategic discussions, and you will probably smile, in terms of it's called PAA, which basically measures, it triangulates, it. You know, you swipe in, but it also triangulates in terms of whether you're in the building or not as well. So it gives you two types of measurements. And what it says is your attendance. It doesn't necessarily says it's Michael there, but it says that you've come in the building and we've counted you as a one. We also count in customers as well, and we also count visitors. So we can tell exactly, in a real-time basis, how many people we actually have in the building at any one time. And so when you sit down with discussions with, and it's exactly what I've been doing in Thames Valley Park, is saying, okay, right, Michael, you've asked for 80 desks, but actually the data that I can see in front of me says that on average, you know, you only have 40 people attending. So why are you asking me for 80 desks when actually the data is telling me that I've only got 40 people inside the building? And so that's really empirical.
Yeah.
You know, and that's fantastic data to actually sit down with a client and say, you're not going to get 80 desks, you're going to get 40, because that's what the data is telling me. Now, clearly, you know, that there are days when you've got team meetings and everybody comes in. But to add to sort of, you know, more to the conversation, we're creating more spaces where people can actually go and sit and actually work. And for the first time ever, I've actually sat on a beanbag and actually did some work the other day, and I actually loved it. and actually, if you go into our Munich office, it's super cool, because again, the Microsoft evolution is about encouraging our clients to also come in and work within our environments too. And so, you know, in our Munich office, the ground floor is dedicated to clients. So you can come in, you can sit on one of our beanbags, you can sit and work, you can go into our restaurant, and you can have, you know, lunch and whatever, and it can be your space. And it's amazing.
And you're measuring, it is amazing, and it's one of the ways business seems to be shifting, and if you like, we're much more fluid in terms of who comes in and out of buildings. Creates a whole bunch of mm-hmm. other issues, of course, around
security
and
absolutely.
All of those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it seems the collaboration in business is something that is becoming more and more prevalent,
mm-hmm.
which I guess is being driven by the fact that we have a good technology.
Correct.
But also there's somehow a change in business almost thinking that allows companies to say, we do need to collaborate, we can't do it all ourselves. And you see this across all businesses.
Completely.
You see in the pharma business, very deliberate, and in fact, now beginning to affect where people locate.
Mm-hmm.
So almost an old-fashioned view that you want to locate next to other people who are doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. and spin-offs and universities and all of this. So there's a whole kind of locational aspect to this as well as the design.
And in some places like Israel, we do co-locate next to the university because that's the model, the business model that we're trying to emulate.
And that's to get engineers to join Microsoft, or because you're partnering with really smart people sat inside the university
it's
on
both.
New products?
Again, you know, we have a huge presence in Cambridge for exactly that.
So your role, and we're, I'm just saying we're bouncing all over the place, which I love, but your role is everything to do with real estate.
It is for Europe.
So Europe, Middle East and Africa.
Correct.
Right. So we've talked a little bit about the inside of the space, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't touched much on the FM side and also what we just talked about, which is the locational bit. So maybe we just talk a little bit about location, because so if Microsoft is setting up a new office in a new country today, mm-hmm. how do you think about where you want that office to be? And probably depends on what you're going to do in that office. And maybe there's not many countries where you don't have offices. I don't know. So
I was going to say, yeah,
so you don't have that problem.
You know, we are highly representative across EMEA, actually. And that was one of the reasons, again, you know, we have 6.6 million square feet in Europe. It's pretty vast. Yeah. It's probably bigger than most global portfolios in itself. So let's take, for example,
you're everywhere.
We are practically.
Or if you were moving, say you've got a lease coming to an end, and mm-hmm. you say, okay, we've got the opportunity to renew where we are or move, and forget about costs for a minute, because sure. obviously that impacts it. But locationally, what kind of things are you thinking about now?
Well, we work with brokers, we work with the business to understand what both of the needs are and whether we can match the requirements. So let's take, for example, you know, we touched on India. We're now actually growing in Africa. So we've got Nigeria and we've got Kenya. So two places that we're actually growing. And we've actually, this is also in the press, so it's something that obviously I can talk about because we've been... we've been very vocal about it, and we're very proud to actually start to innovate in some really, really cool countries. And so, you know, for us, you know, the building stock. So it goes back to our conversation about India, you know, many, many years ago, the building stock isn't quite what it is, you know, in some of the other European countries. And there is a challenge, and it's about looking at what there is in the market and actually taking some pragmatic views where, you know, the market isn't so sophisticated.
Yeah, and I guess the reason I was asking the question is if you look at London, yeah, it would be 5 years, we've seen a lot of the technology companies move into London in a major way.
Definitely.
Locate themselves over hubs, transport hubs,
mm-hmm.
With, I guess, you could argue the exception of Apple, of Battersea, but obviously Paddington, Victoria, King's Cross are mm-hmm. a major transport hubs. And there's this big shift from, and you were talking about Thames Valley Park, which in a way is the old technology hubs were
corridor.
in out-of-town mm-hmm. suburban office parks. Whereas the new ones, at least if you look at London, seem to be in cities. Can you, is that a trend that, well, I'm sure you're looking at it as Microsoft, but how does that, and I know you've got a presence obviously in London as well, but is that shift about employment? Is it about realistic? Because obviously the property is more expensive, so you wouldn't do it. You're not doing it for a cost point of view. So just from the technology world, what's driving that? That's so different from 10, 20 years ago.
And you know, it goes from Microsoft as it goes from American Express, which is that, you know, you need to create offices where the talent is. And, you know, for American Express, you know, you've got Brighton and you've also got, you know, some parts just outside of London. People want to be in London, sort of that community and that type of person doesn't want to go to Brighton, doesn't want to go to Reading necessarily. They want to be in the centre. They want to be where the tech hub is. And so there's been a cultural shift from, you know, outside of London into London, which creates obviously a saturation as well. And so, but you're competing against the Googles, you're competing against Amazon, you're competing against all of these people, including American Express, for the same talent. And so, you know, property does play a major part. It, you know, people want to be where all the action is, and people want it to be an easy commute. And London, unfortunately, you know, the commute is pretty miserable most of the time, is the choice.
Yeah. I just find it fascinating because I think for many years, 10, 20 years, it was, particularly in the tech world, it was all about being out of town and
Indeed.
Getting people to come to you. So it was driving everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And all there were buses laid on from train stations. And then the trend that is now very apparent moving into London, I don't think anyone was talking about or writing about or saying this is what's going to happen. It just sort of happened over time, and now that's all we seem to talk about. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me, as a real estate professional, one of our roles is to spot mega trends, or whatever Indeed. You might call those. And how do we do that? Because whatever anyone says, it wasn't obvious that it was going to happen. And I certainly didn't see anything in the being written or talked about that said it was going to happen. Yet here we are with all the major tech operators and a lot of other people wanting to be in London.
Definitely. And flexibility as well. So again, you know, people talk about flexibility, and whether it be WeWork or whatever it is, you know, sort of that. Again, you know, 10 years ago, would we have sat here and figured out that WeWork or its equivalent, you know, the Regus then, you know, you and I used to know Regus was just sort of elite cutting edge, but, you know, it's just, and interesting enough, we were talking about business continuity as well yesterday. And, you know, where does the flexible office work in terms of business continuity? So all of a sudden, starting to sort of think about some really different real estate strategic options that are now available because the market is so much more flexible than it was even 10 years ago.
And I guess what's fascinating for the next 5 to 10 years, and maybe we sort of talk about this and wrap up, but it seems to me that with all the technology, then we've talked about that a lot, and then if you like the change in what people entering the workforce now expect, we're in this period of rapid change. And none of us know where that's going to end up, of course, but our jobs have to allow us to think about that and maybe come up with ideas. So as you say, the rise of flexible working from technology and the rise of flexible office space, mm-hmm. or space as a service, are two of the huge trends that are going on. Sustainability, wellness, corporate social responsibility, another big trend. But how do you, in your role, kind of, I mean, I'm sure you follow them, but do you have people within Microsoft who are looking at those sort of big trends that you get information from that helps you inform what you're doing? Because that's something I haven't seen that I'm kind of curious about.
Absolutely. And we have, you know, as a part of the Redmond team, we have people who do research. We also have people who do surveys. So talk, you know, we're regularly doing surveys, touching with our engineers, sort of understanding what they need so that we can actually develop the workplace for the future for exactly those needs. And so it's very scientific, and we do spend a lot of time looking at it. So absolutely.
And what you touched on there, which I think is interesting, is it, and you mentioned it earlier, but you're obviously the type of company you are, but it's all about data. I mean, I'm imagining the way you get anything done inside Microsoft is by having data, not Mary Louise had a great idea in the shower this morning and is going to mm-hmm. yep. push that through. You wouldn't get anywhere. And some companies do work like that, but mm-hmm. others, in your case, but it seems to me that everyone needs that data.
We do. And it ours exist. Is called Power BI. Yeah. So it's something, and actually we were looking at it yesterday, but it's only as good as the data that goes into it. So garbage in, garbage out. And you know, the importance of actually cleansing the data is so critical, and having one golden source, which we do.
Yeah. And I think in that sense, you're lucky because that's the business. So they understand it. So they'll spend the money on it. I think, you know, my reflection on it is the further away you get from tech businesses or businesses that use data as part of their day-to-day business, the harder it is to get companies to understand they need data points for us to do our jobs. So I guess you've got the luxury of working for a very big global company that also loves data and will listen to you when you use data.
And you bring up another interesting point, which is leading and lagging data. So we do a lot of, you know, lagging data analysis. So, and then, but we don't.
So, what do you mean by lagging data?
So, lagging is past. Yeah. So, the more powerful thing is about leading indicators. It's about looking at the future. It's about what does the data tell me, and how am I going to change things? And that's the leading indicators. Right. How am I going to actually change things? And a lot of us just spend too much time actually looking at, you know, what's lagging. Gone on, yeah. and not what does the data tell me, so that I actually change things to make sure that A, it doesn't happen again, and secondly, that actually we're smarter going forwards.
Okay, so maybe we could finish up, but we've touched on a lot of things, and I mean, we'll go back a little bit to your career, but it I think we got to the point where you wanted a European job and you got one, and then we kind of fast forwarded. It's great. But if you look back on your career and the different jobs you've had, can you maybe we could talk a little bit about what's not so much why did you move on, but what has led to that success, and what are the things that are really important if you're thinking about having a long-term career in real estate that you need to be doing as you go through, which maybe at the time you didn't realize, but with hindsight you go, oh yeah, I did do that, and that's what's led to this.
Mm-hmm. I just think people can learn the trade, but you can't learn passion. You need that passion and fire in your belly. And sometimes when I talk to people, if you don't have that passion, you're not going to make, you know, sort of a huge success in something that you're doing. And you can learn anything. But you just can't learn that creativity and that passion, the need to learn. And every day I come into an office and I learn something new every day. And when I stop learning, it's time to move on. And that's my sort of my barometer. When I can't change anything, I can't make more impact. And I sometimes think that people don't make brave enough decisions and recognize sometimes when it's time to move on. And I've been very fortunate that people have sort of knocked on my door and said, would you like to go and do this? And I go, yeah, okay, great. I'll go and do that. So I've been incredibly lucky. But you do also make your own luck too.
You do. And I think what you're describing, I quite often refer to as curiosity. It's very, really, and that's the passion part. Am I really interested in this? And have I thought about it? And what about doing it this way and that way? And then I think if you're like that inside certain companies, you can flourish and you have a career. And others, as you say, you hit that point where no one's interested in listening or changing. And then I guess you feel like you need to move on.
And I've also been very fortunate that I've done both sides. So, you know, I've had a unique career where I've been a service provider and I've been a client. So, I do recognize both sides. And so sometimes when I sit and we have some tricky discussions, I can see it from both perspectives. And I also would encourage that everybody should do both just to sort of feel it, because I do think it makes you a much more informed client being in the wider operative word.
Great. Well, I think on that note, we need to draw this to a close. Mary-Louise, it's been fascinating. I've learned tons, which is always good. and I look forward to having you back as we delve into some more things later on.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate it. Thank you.